Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning on the show, we're discussing the process of coming out of lockdown and how different that may be for many people. Students on the autism spectrum and adults in the workplace as well may have anxiety about returning to the social settings of school and the job site. We'll hear from experts on both of those topics. Also, right now, what does your wardrobe look like for the day? Is it similar to what you've had on, well, maybe just over a year ago? We'll speak with a fashion professor about how our clothing choices have changed during the pandemic and how that could affect dress code guidelines moving forward. But first up this morning, at the start of the pandemic, Cap Radio was receiving many questions from you, our audience, in many different forms, emails, phone calls, social media. Initially, our digital team saw questions regarding how to get personal protective equipment, and if certain cleaners could be used for proper disinfecting, how long the virus survives on surfaces, and those sorts of things. Remember when it was all about touch? As time went on and more research was done on COVID-19, the topics of the questions shifted, with vaccinations taking center stage. Just last week, on the anniversary of the statewide lockdown, Cap Radio's digital team took to answering as many questions as they could for an entire day. Cap Radio's managing editor of digital content, Chris Hagen, is here now to share some of the highlights of that process and his own experience with it. Chris, good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We used to be neighbors in the Cap Radio newsroom and shared many, many laughs throughout the day. I'm looking forward to the day that that returns. Given the timing of your question palooza, I'm guessing it was somewhat of a spring cleaning.
Yeah, a little bit. It's one of those things where, as you mentioned, we did it on the anniversary of the lockdown, or the first stay at home order. And we were looking for a way to kind of mark that. And, you know, as you mentioned, we've been collecting these questions all through the pandemic, and especially over the past month, we've been getting a lot more questions about vaccines. Especially, we've gotten more than 300 just about vaccinations.
Wow.
And over the past month, these have been kind of piling up a little bit because, you know, one, the vaccine eligibility has been changing a lot in California, so there's a lot of questions. But then the supply has also been increasing enough that more people think that they may have access to it or may be able to get an appointment. So we've been getting a lot more questions. And the idea actually came from our audience engagement editor, Helga Salinas, who was inspired by this group in New York, who are actually signing people up for vaccination appointments, who, you know, people who may have trouble doing it themselves. For various reasons, we're not able to do that as a station with, you know, personal information requirements in California and things like that. But what we could do is go back to these questions that we've been getting and answer as many as we could.
Yeah. So give us a sense of how long it takes to answer the average question. There probably isn't an average question.
But exactly.
You get the idea.
That's the hard thing. And really, like I mentioned, like the eligibility requirements in California mean that every question is very different. The most common question we get is someone who says, this is my age, this is my underlying health condition or my occupation, and this is the county I live in. And so there's 58 different counties in California and even more different health systems within California. And each of those have a different answer to that question. And so for us, it takes a lot of time to research, well, what are the requirements in this county? Because we're getting questions from all over the state.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we've answered the question before for someone in a similar situation, that goes very quickly. But if it's a very detailed question and very specific to someone's situation, we want to give them the information that's as close to what they're experiencing as we can.
You don't take the easy route and just direct them to the source?
As much as possible, we try to get, you know, if someone says that, you know, I got a question from someone who's a construction worker in Orange County, and so I want to try to find as much as I can, what are the requirements for construction workers in Orange County?
Yeah, is it surprising to you how specific the questions get, or are people good about asking generalized questions?
No, people ask very specific questions, and I think that's part of the issues that people are finding, because it's those people who are right on the edge. We get a lot of questions from people who say, I'm 64 and a half, and right now California's eligibility is for people 65 and over, and so they want to know, do I have to wait until my birthday, or can I get it now? And people who have an occupation that sounds like something that's currently in the requirements, but it's not super clear from the California Department of Public Health requirements if they actually fit. And so that's where we come in to try to research that. And unfortunately, there's not a clear answer in every case, but we try to get people as much information as we can.
So if I personally had a question surrounding COVID-19, I don't know that I would go to CAP Radio to get it answered if I didn't work, you know, already work here. Is there any confusion about who we are as an organization? And if so, what happens in those instances?
Yeah, we've occasionally gotten questions from people who may think that we're connected with, you know, a government agency in some way, or who may have, you know, direct access to vaccines. But I think, I mean, a lot of it comes out of, there are people who are really, you know, desperate for this information and are asking everyone they can and aren't getting a lot of feedback. You know, we heard from someone whose question we answered this past week, who replied to us and said, you know, thanks so much for responding. It means a lot to hear from someone, because I've been on all of these websites and I haven't heard back from anyone. And so people are looking for anyone who may be able to answer or get them some more information, you know, whether it's a county public health department or a public radio station in Sacramento.
And my question to you wasn't to indicate that CAP Radio wouldn't have those types of answers. I tune to us all the time for, you know, great information. But in seeking out that stuff, it just wouldn't be at the top of my list. Maybe it's reporter in me. I would go to a government agency or something. So what do you do when people ask for medical advice?
Yeah, we try to be really careful about not giving out specific medical advice. One of the questions I answered on Friday was someone who had a question about allergies and how that interacts with the vaccine. And in that case, I just had to say, you need to, if you can, contact your doctor or your health system. And that is not an option for everyone. So I know that's not a great answer, but it's not something that we can do. As you mentioned, as reporters, we are not medical professionals. We can direct people to, you know, CDC information or ways to have that conversation with their doctor, but we can't recommend, yes, you should get the vaccine or not get the vaccine. It's, you know, it's more about providing information so people can make their own choices.
Mm-hmm. Chris, some of these questions have now arrived to CAP Radio in the form of audio that people can hear the actual people asking the question. And I understand we have a few of those.
Yeah, we have a question from someone named Senta, who had a question about how to interact with family members after you may be vaccinated.
My immediate family has been very eager to get vaccinated as soon as possible, and we feel very fortunate that some of us are getting a second dose this week, and others are on a brief waiting list to get a first dose. We're all feeling a sense of relief that we will have a defense against this invisible threat, and excited to be in each other's company like old times again. It surprised me when I reached out to extended family to share local vaccination information, just how many of them said they weren't sure if they were going to get vaccinated. This made me wonder, how do fully vaccinated individuals safely interact with friends and family who are choosing not to be immunized?
Yeah, Chris, I think Senta brings up a question that a lot of us are wondering. Many of us are in, I guess, what we would call mixed families. You know, we're on varying levels of vaccination, with some people maybe choosing not to get vaccinated at all. What sort of information do you then present, Senta?
Yeah, and this was a case where there were some recommendations that we could provide, because the CDC had put out guidance on this recently. And so, you know, what we sent her was some reporting that NPR had done on this, and also a link to the CDC recommendations, would say that specifically that you can, if you are fully vaccinated, your family and your household's fully vaccinated, you can visit with other fully vaccinated people indoors without wearing a mask or physical distancing. And then you can visit with an unvaccinated people from a single household. And this was their recommendations, that, you know, not any household, but maybe you pick one that you want to visit with and kind of limit your risk. And with people in that household who are at low risk for severe COVID-19, so maybe not people who are older or people who have certain underlying health conditions that could make them more vulnerable to the disease. And you could maybe mix with that household without wearing masks or physical distancing. But again, they mentioned that in most settings, even if you are vaccinated, you should be wearing a mask if you're outdoors, outside of your own household, and that you should be still following these kind of COVID protocols that we've all been adhering to since this time last year.
Yeah, good information, Chris. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's managing editor of digital content, Chris Hagen, about the types of questions CAP Radio's digital team has been getting and answering since the start of the pandemic. We did receive another response from listener Matt Rosenberg. Tell us about that, Chris.
Yeah, Matt had two questions. And again, this kind of gets back to some of those like very specific questions we were talking about before. He wanted to know about this idea of vaccine passports. And then also he wanted some information about the percentage of people who have received a vaccine shot who also might be hospitalized with COVID.
Why isn't California, or for that matter, the United States, using some kind of passport system like Israel is for those who are vaccinated to be able to engage in more activities? It might really incentivize vaccination. My other question is, what percentage of people in hospital or in ICUs in the area have already been vaccinated? Are the only people ending up in ICUs not vaccinated? Or are we seeing a few vaccinated people in the hospital?
Those are both good questions. And when we did a travel show last week, we got lots of questions regarding the sort of vaccination passport that would make it easier for travel. So what were you able to find for those, Chris?
Yeah, so in the first question, there's a little bit more information. There are various things in the United States that make something like a vaccine passport really hard. One of them is there's a lot of different, obviously moving between states and counties, there's different regulations and different ways that people are tracking the vaccine data. The big thing is that there are concerns around privacy in setting up a big system like that holds medical information for, say, every American. And we found that there are airline and business groups that are very interested in this, that have lobbied the White House to kind of take a lead in setting these sort of standards. Mm-hmm. But so far, the Biden administration has said that this is something that would be more suited for like the private sector or nonprofits versus the government to figure out. And so that's going to be a thing that holds up something like this in the United States. To his other question, that this is one of those things where there's not necessarily a satisfying answer yet, where we had to let him know that there isn't data for something like how many patients in ICUs may have received the vaccine already. That's one of those things where that data hasn't been collected in a standardized way yet. You know, there are reports from various places about COVID vaccines preventing people from getting, you know, more severe cases, but right now that's still something that that's hasn't been tracked in the way that he would want to yet.
As somebody who loves data, I know that you are anxiously awaiting that information. I imagine we'll get some big data dumps in the months to come when related to the vaccine's efficacies. So how does, other than the way that we just did it on the air, how does the answer get back to the asker?
The main way we've been doing it is just emailing people individually. And that was the big thing that we did last Friday, as we emailed almost, you know, 50 people direct answers to their questions, because, you know, as we said, a lot of the questions are very specific. It's something that's hard to answer in, say, a general article. You know, it's something that we can't really do in, you know, 500 or 600 words. And so in that case, it's much better to just email someone individually and say, hey, this is the information we have. This is the best way to get an answer to your question. We do have a kind of a big vaccine FAQ article on our website that does try to do some of that general stuff and provide links for people to find, say, their county health department if they want to look for more information there, or for some of the state websites where there is more vaccine information. But for the most part, we try to email as many people as we can one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. We had a short discussion a little bit earlier about what type of organization, or confusion about what type of organization CAP Radio it is. You told our producer, Cynthia Lopez, that you started getting questions from people as to whether CAP Radio could get them access to a vaccine. How did that get started?
Well, we've had some luck in getting people the information they need to actually sign up for appointments. And we got a couple of questions from people who had friends who had received information from us, and they said, oh, you know, go to CAP Radio. They were able to get me the vaccine, but I think it was a little bit of telephone where, yeah, you know, we got people information to help them sign up, but didn't have access to it, but that was, we got a couple of questions that are, I heard you were able to get my friend an appointment. Can you help me out here? And, you know, we were able to provide them information, but obviously we don't have that direct access.
So especially with a topic like COVID-19, information's constantly changing, accurate information changes. How do you go about updating answers when that happens?
Yeah, unfortunately, we aren't able to, say, email everyone back when something changes related to their question. So we try to give people information, so if they need to look it up again, they can. But then the main thing, as I mentioned, we have this vaccine FAQ article on our website. You can find it at capradio.org/coronavirus. And we update that as things change. So, you know, if California changes eligibility requirements again, or if Sacramento County has more vaccine clinics open up, we'll update information there so people can go and find it on their own as things change.
Yeah, and that's a good portal for people to get you new questions.
Exactly. We also have a form on that page where you can ask us questions about the vaccine or anything related to the coronavirus.
Yeah. Chris Hagan, Cap Radio's managing editor of digital content. Always great to chat with you, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Up next, a look at the social anxiety some face as we get closer to reopening and how parents of children with autism can help ease the transition of going back to in-person learning. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. I've been down since I began to crawl. If it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning, we're discussing our transitions from stay-at-home orders back to our social interactions as we once knew them just over a year ago. More people in the United States are getting their vaccines, which means many are seeing a light at the end of the COVID tunnel. As of Monday, data from the CDC shows about 1 in 4 of us have now received at least one vaccination. Across social media, people have shown they're excited about having get-togethers with their friends and family members who have also been vaccinated to celebrate. But what about those of us with social anxiety? How does a return to normal work? Well, here to walk us through his reporting on the anxiety summer feeling from the imminent return of social gatherings is New York Times reporter Matt Richtel. He joins us today from his home in San Francisco. Welcome to Insight, Matt.
Morning, Randall.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Congratulations, by the way, on living in one of California's largest cities that's now in an orange-tiered county. I guess only San Jose is larger in that category. So,
San Francisco is a little bit of an island. You got to get here by a bridge. So, you know, maybe right. Maybe we're a touch like Kauai with fog.
Yeah, and lots of return to social activities in that city. Matt, you spoke with a man, Jonathan Hershon, who felt relieved when he no longer had to attend, you know, dinner parties, outings, or to go into work. I think many of us could relate to Jonathan on some level, at least at first, realizing, you know, that each of us had at least some introverted tendencies. However, explain how the pandemic changed the way Jonathan interacted with his friends and peers over time.
Yeah. Jonathan is characteristic of a number of people I spoke to who discovered what they knew all along, which is that a little more structure and a little less social chaos felt pretty good. Can you relate?
Yeah, I can. Actually, I remember the early days of the pandemic and thinking it's kind of nice to be here at home, you know, in my backyard. Over time, though, I'm a very social person and I really wanted to get back out again.
Well, Randall, this is the science bears this out, and it's quite interesting. Sometimes as a journalist, not sometimes, always, I am looking for either the counterintuitive or the piece that may be glossed over by cliche. And what the cliche in this instance said was, everybody is bereft. Mm-hmm. Now, in many respects, everybody I spoke to, in fact, in all respects, said, this is you know, an abyss in so many ways. Big but. If you look at the data, about half the people reporting to the American Psychological Association, I believe is the name, said that their mental health got worse. About half said it said the same, stayed the same, and about 10% said it improved. What I noticed along the way was a number of friends and family, and then ultimately sources, saying, you know, I really like going to bed at night knowing what my day feels like tomorrow. And that was the most pertinent quote I got all along. Does that, I'm not talking necessarily about those with extreme social anxiety. I'm talking about the spectrum of those with rather extreme social anxiety and those who have felt that life has been moving awfully fast and there's a lot of chaos associated with it.
Yeah, and people don't need to have social anxiety really to feel uneasy about this return to normal, as we're calling it.
Yeah.
What are some thoughts and worries that you have heard through your reporting about this process, about what we're now facing?
Yeah, I would summarize the thoughts and worries I've heard through a theorem I should never state aloud called the CAT theory of life.
The CAT theory, C-A-T?
C-A-T. Have you ever had a cat, Randall?
Yes, uh-huh.
Have you ever moved with a cat?
Moved from one home to another?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Well, when we've moved, the cat will spend the first few days hiding under something. And my observation of the people that I've spoken to is that as we travel through life, there is a bit of cat in all of us, even those of us who are dog people, who need to get accustomed to new surroundings. And the regularity with which we move on a regular basis causes some part of us to want to withdraw. And that is that much more pronounced with those who have social anxiety. What I have heard from people is a couple of things. One, maybe I'll be a little more judicious with how I plan my time and the circumstances I put myself in. But the more interesting one, Randall, that I think I've heard is I have heard people say they are cutting out activities that they once took for granted or did through the momentum of time. And that I think is where a very interesting spot. Randall, I want to be really cautious here for the listeners and state one thing outright. Nobody is saying that the pandemic is a good thing.
Right.
This has to come within that context. But I am hearing from people saying, I used to go to the theater. It was fun. I'm not sure it's worth the mild anxiety it caused before. I'd be curious if listeners are out there, what they are feeling along these lines.
Yeah. And then it gets complicated on top of that, Matt. Currently, more than 3 out of 4 of us are not vaccinated. Even the vaccines, as good as they are not 100% effective in stopping the virus. Talk a bit about the added worry of possibly getting COVID-19 through social interactions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's amplified the social anxiety for those who have it. And for those who have decided social anxiety, meaning a clinical version, and OCD is another, if you read the article in the Times, you'll see those are singled out by the therapists and clinicians. Those are people who already were quite nervous. If you are nervous about social interaction or germs, regular hand washing, this hybrid period we're in certainly feels quite uncertain or could.
Yeah. Do psychologists think that with the pandemic, some patients may have maybe lost the progress that they were making?
Randall, I'm glad you brought that up because maybe from a scientific standpoint, this is the single most compelling thing I learned in the course of doing this. If you are someone with social anxiety or an OCD condition that may be related, although two different things, apparently the very best therapy is exposure therapy. That's what it's called. You go through an activity that in point of fact is not all that threatening and realize that. In the course of the pandemic, what it's done is removed the daily exposure therapy that many with these clinical conditions benefit from, although they are difficult conditions. And now it is as if starting from zero. And several of the therapists, if you read the article, are quite pointed in their concerns about the challenge of returning to life.
And I highly recommend that people do read the article. We have it linked at capradio.org/insight. I could talk to you for another 20 minutes, but I'm up against the clock. New York Times reporter based in San Francisco, Matt Richtel, thank you so much for joining us today with some of your insights.
Thanks, guys. Everybody stay safe.
All right, and you're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking about preparing for a return to some normalcy after more than a year of toggling stay-at-home restrictions. Children going a year without stepping into the classroom are preparing for a return to some form of in-person instruction if they haven't already started. We all remember our first day back to school and how it was often a mix of excitement and anxiety. Well, for some students with special needs, that anxiety may be just off the charts, especially those with autism spectrum disorder, since transitions and a change of routines can be particularly stressful. Cap Radio's Vicky Gonzalez spoke with the UC Davis Mind Institute, which published 10 tips to help kids with autism transition back to in-person school. Here's that conversation recorded yesterday.
Patricia Shetter is a behavior analyst and coordinator of autism education initiatives at the UC Davis Mind Institute. Patricia, thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we know the past year has been a struggle across the board when it comes to children and families with distance learning. And there's been a long concern that special needs children will regress academically and even in some cases developmentally. When it comes to children on the autism spectrum, what are you seeing firsthand?
Well, we have approximately 133,000 students that are between the ages of 3 and 22 who are served in our public schools in California with autism. And as you can imagine, you know, this pandemic and having to shift from in-person learning to distance learning has been really stressful on all kids, but certainly children with special needs and children with autism tend to struggle a little bit more than I think even typical children with the transition.
And when you say 130,000 children, is that across California?
Yeah, that's across the entire state.
When it comes to a return to the classroom, and some families, they're getting there, I can imagine on the one hand, that's a long overdue benefit, but the classroom experience is going to be a lot different. And this is on top of a year of lots of changes. How could this new transition be a challenge, particularly for children with autism?
So I think change is generally, you know, a challenge for all children, and the transition back to school is going to present with lots of challenges for everyone. For children with autism, dealing with newness and transitions can be particularly challenging. So, you know, having to adapt to a new and different routine in and of itself, I think will be challenging, but having to learn all of the new safety protocols and procedures and, you know, try to understand why they need to wear a mask and what is this social distancing and, you know, adapting to a lot of the new expectations and rules is going to be challenging.
And the UC Davis Mind Institute has a list of tips online. I was reading through those tips for families, and one of the quotes that really stuck out to me was that students, they need to be comfortable in order to reengage and connect. Can you go a little bit more in depth about how you're helping guide families through these pretty difficult adjustments?
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, there's a lot of things that families and educators can do to help children feel comfortable during this transition. Some things families can even begin doing before the transition happens. Preparing the student for the eventual transition back to in-person instruction is important. Things like doing a drive by the school or on the weekend going and walking the campus and pointing out some of the new safety guidelines, like the arrows on the ground, and practicing, you know, walking in that direction and understanding what those arrows mean can all be things that can be done in advance and that can really help to prepare students. teachers need to do a lot too, you know, to help kids feel comfortable. I mean, imagine going and meeting your teacher and only being able to see half of their face. You know, who is this person behind this mask? So we recommend that teachers do things like taking a picture of themselves without their mask on, maybe introducing themselves to the student through Zoom or you know, with a picture of themselves so that the student actually sees what their teacher looks like without that mask on their face. And that can, you know, go a long way to helping to connect and, you know, getting to know that person in the context of this new classroom environment. Some of the other things that can be really helpful when it comes to the transition are showing photos of the classroom and you know, the desks being farther apart, and maybe some of, if they're using any of the barriers and what those are and what those look like, just to give kids a sense of what the classroom is going to look like now as opposed to what it might have looked like the last time that they were there.
Yeah, I especially like the illustrations that you have called Autism Little Learners, and that's preparing students for those changes that they're going to experience. It kind of develops that routine on the front end so those changes don't feel so scary when they're actually experiencing them.
Yeah, we have several resources called social stories or social narratives that are on the resource Padlet on the Mind Institute's website that can be used to help prepare and help students understand what the differences are going to be or might be when they return to school.
You know, finally, the overarching concern is learning loss from distance learning, not being able to get that crucial time back. What can parents and teachers do to close that gap when it comes to children on the autism spectrum?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that that's a prevailing concern for many parents and teachers, is not knowing how much might have been lost during this time away from that traditional face-to-face learning. And I think people's tendency is going to be to really want to jump in intensively and start working on some of those skills. But, you know, the kids really have to feel comfortable and readjust and get acclimated to being back in the school environment first. And it's going to take teachers a little time to really assess, you know, where students are, both academically as well as socially and emotionally. So after a period of adjustment and a period of time sort of assessing where kids are, I think then individualized learning plans can be developed where some interventions can be thought about and put in place. And those, you know, can really range from, you know, tutoring, one-on-one intensive support, small group instruction. I know a lot of schools are looking at extending the school year, maybe providing some before and after school interventions for kids as needed. But I really think that, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time to truly assess where kids are. And they're going to be at different levels, you know, with academics and with social emotional skills.
Any other concerns that the UC Davis Mind Institute has when it comes to these pretty big adjustments?
Well, I think that, you know, there's going to be a period of adjustment for families as well. And caregivers, you know, especially have had a lot on their plates this last year, wearing multiple hats, you know, being the caregiver as well as the teacher and the behavior manager and lots of things. And so while I think there may be probably some sense of relief that comes with, you know, having kids go back to school and having some of those things lifted and shared with the educators, I think too that, you know, it's going to be a huge adjustment for families as well. And so doing some good self-care and making sure that families are really, you know, taking care of themselves during this period of adjustment and readjustment is going to be important.
Yeah, I think we've all had to learn to develop and fine-tune that patience, and that's still needed as we're rounding a corner.
Yeah, and I think being patient with the teachers and the educators as this transition takes place, you know, they're having to learn now not just how to do online learning, but hybrid and managing schedules and, you know, helping the kids adjust socially and emotionally. And so I think that patience all the way around and collaboration and teamwork is going to be so essential as we move into this new way of doing education.
Yeah, and as we know, you know, despite this being a pandemic and having distance learning, life doesn't stop. What about families with children who have just been diagnosed with autism?
Yeah, receiving an initial diagnosis can be a scary time in general as you're coming to terms with it and trying to figure out what your child needs and what the services and resources are that are out there. And, you know, that looks a lot different now than it did a year and a half ago. And it may be that parents are put on a waiting list for a particular service as things kind of come back online, or they may be offered to do some kind of hybrid therapies as opposed to traditional in-person therapy. I think the most important thing for parents is just to, you know, find the right fit for what works for them and their families, you know, given all the safety precautions, working with the providers and figuring out what the best fit is for them.
Patricia Shetter is a behavior analyst and coordinator of autism education initiatives at the UC Davis Mind Institute. Thank you so much for taking time with us.
Thank you so much.
And that was CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez. The interview was recorded yesterday, and we do have a link to the 10 tips for helping kids with autism transition back to in-person learning, which includes the Autism Little Learners illustrations and social stories from the UC Davis Mind Institute. Of course, find that at capradio.org/insight. Still ahead, fashion thoughts as we transition out of our pajama onesies back to appropriate workplace attire. An expert walks us through what's likely to happen with dress codes in the weeks and maybe even years to come. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment. And welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. PJs, slippers, comfy sweatshirts, possibly an unkempt beard or hairstyle. One or all may have become a go-to for you during the pandemic, as many of us swapped the office for the living room or maybe the kitchen table. But as we round a corner and companies plan to welcome at least some employees back into work, will those pre-COVID work outfits make a return, or are we reevaluating how to dress professionally? Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Danielle Mathras, an associate teaching professor of marketing at Northeastern University, about how our pandemic wardrobe could shape future dress codes. I started by asking her, how has COVID-19 shaped the clothes we buy?
Yeah, or are we even buying clothes anymore? I feel badly saying that, though, but you know, you see sales all the time going on in the stores around us and online. It has really changed the clothes we're buying, right? The work from home phenomenon has continued. You know, people are starting to go back now that the vaccine is more prevalent, but it's still not up to the normal levels that we've been at before. And so we're just not buying those things that we used to anymore. We're not wearing through those things anymore. We're not buying things that are dry cleanable anymore, right? Those things that aren't comfortable. We've really shifted the importance that we place on comfort and functionality pre and post pandemic. It's been a wild shift. I worked with I mentor Batul Raza. She is the founder of Jabe, which is a company that literally means pocket in Urdu. And they their flagship product is a women's blazer that has actual functional pockets. And that's their flagship product. They served as one of our marketing research clients for my students at Northeastern, our marketing research students. And this last fall, we examined like the swinging changes that we're going through in terms of what we wear to work and what we wear at home all the time, right? And so we did, I have to give a shout out to my student team who worked on this, but they really found out that before pre-pandemic, style was more important, the most important feature of clothing for over half the people that we interviewed. And after the pandemic, style was only the most important for 15%.
15%, that's 15%. A huge drop. Yeah.
Huge drop. Meanwhile, before the pandemic, comfort was only most important to 14% of people. And post-pandemic, 74% said comfort was their most important feature of the clothing that they're wearing.
You think that's going to stick around?
You know, I just told some of my friends who are, some work from home, some going back into the office. I'm like, what's going to stay the same and what's going to change? I just did like a really quick reach out to them to see what's going on. And most of them said, you know, I can't imagine even wearing pumps anymore. I can't imagine wearing clothes that don't stretch the way I need them to stretch, or that I'm used to leggings stretching, right? And so I think we've really become, because I think when, let's be honest, when this all happened back in March last year, I mean, it was going on before then, but when it really all affected all of us, we thought it was going to be a 2-week thing, you know, everything's going to be back to normal in 2 weeks. Yeah. Here we are over a year later, and we've gotten used to certain things. We've gotten used to being comfortable. We've gotten used to cozy fabrics that kind of are comforting, because we need that in our lives. We're socially isolated, right? So we need those comforting things. And clothing is one of the ways that we can get that comfort, whether, yeah, you know, physical and psychological comfort.
So true. Danielle, I remember, I think it was maybe late last spring or early summer, there were some studies that were showing that people online were only buying tops. they weren't buying anything below the Zoom camera lens. Did that stick around?
I think that has stuck around quite a bit. So I did a little bit of searching on before we were talking today. And Zoom tops, the like dress from the waist up, it's almost like the notion of the mullet, right? Like the business in the on top and the party on the bottom. Right. That sort of thing. Right. But that seems to still be going on quite a bit, especially for the work, obviously the work from home folks.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm most interested in is the people who are returning to work now. I have a lot of friends who are in industries and a lot, and you know, just following these stories, I'm hearing about people starting to go back into the office. So what are they buying? And they're buying things like comfortable pants that still look appropriate. You know, there's even a brand out there that has these pants. They're wear to work pants, but you're also supposed to be able to do yoga in them, right? And so it's the notion that I can look formal, I can look appropriate, but I'm still going to be comfortable.
I was wearing those pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the brand.
The ones I'm talking about.
I do know the one. And somebody even mentioned to me, oh, I like your pants. You know, those are nice and dressy. And I said, you know, I can do yoga in them. And, yeah. You know, I grew up on the West Coast.
Okay.
And the casual work attire really got its start here. And I remember going in the 90s, going to Boston, where you are, and I was not let into a nightclub because I didn't have the right shoes on. And it blew my mind. I was like, wait, what? You're not going to let me in here because I don't have the right shoes on? I just didn't compute. So do you think it's regional? I can see here on the West Coast, the casual attire sticking around for a very long time, if not forever. Do you think cities that are a little more laced up, like New York and Boston, maybe Chicago, might transition back to the way it was a little more quickly?
I think some of the client-facing roles, right? If you're thinking about ad agencies, if you're thinking about financial investments, you're going to get people that, you know, that you maintain that level of professionalism with that workwear. But Boston is like booming with tech now, right? Tech companies, tons of startups, they're all super casual, right?
Yeah.
You know, you might see people wearing button-down shirts or things like that, but they're wearing jeans and sneakers just like on the West Coast too. So I think, you know, we used to laugh, right? I remember casual Fridays back in the day, like that used to be a right. thing. Like now it's pretty much all the time. But no, I think it's certain industries and really depending on your role as to whether you need to be buttoned up or not, or depending on your, you know, how are you a media facing person, where, you know, what is the sort of identity you're trying to display for your company and for yourself? They always, you know, that adage, you know, dress for the role you want, not the one you have, that sort of thing. So I think people still keep that in mind, but when their bosses and their bosses' bosses are wearing hoodies on Zoom calls, it's probably okay if they are as well.
It is something I check. That's funny that you said that. So how, what about the fashion industry? How are they going to morph along with this? I know that fashion takes months, if not years, for it to go from design to manufacture and then end up on the shelves. So how do they quickly adjust to meet the current needs?
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't right away, right? But it's the ones that were able to kind of see what was going on and kind of adapt to that. So I think a lot of the fashion companies are doing some research on what happened during the Depression and what happened during the Great Recession and what came out of that, right? A lot of flashiness came out, right? Especially when there's an economic constriction, like you don't want to be seen as being too over the top or too showy in terms of the types of fashions that you're.
So more minimalist.
A little bit more, exactly. Yeah, a little bit more minimalist, more muted colors. The lines are a little bit more simple in terms of versus like puffy shoulders or things like that. And so that's what came out of some of those past economic constrictions. And I think that fashion companies are taking a role from history, right? We learn from history and they're taking a look back to see what will be coming out of this on the other end. I think another thing is consumers are now thinking a little bit more in terms of investment pieces, right? So, you know, I do need to go back to work, but I've done such a good job over the pandemic while I've been home of getting rid of things that I don't need that are too fashion forward or too trendy. And now I want to invest in something that's a little bit more timeless, a little bit trendless, let's say, instead of trendy. And so thinking about pieces a little bit more in terms of that, right? How is this gonna last for a long time?
Quality,
exactly.
Yeah, maybe going with something locally made and spending more money on it, but get away from that whole throwaway wardrobe culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think that the fashion companies that are considering all of those things are going to be the ones that do well. It's just still pretty disheartening to see all the sales going on and everything. And knowing that, you know, they just think of all the creative work that went into create these lines that just never really got worn. And it's really sad to think about that. But I think another thing that's been really interesting is, you know, people getting more like slightly more muted tones and everything like that now. But I'm really curious as to what's going to happen. I could totally see this going one of two ways. We're going to be set in our pandemic ways and want these like pieces that go together, minimal, kind of these capsule wardrobe type of things where people are having fewer sets of clothing items, but that all go together and everything. They're comfortable. They all work together. To maybe it's going to be like a sigh of relief or like a ripping the Band-Aid off where people are like, oh my goodness, I can now go out to a restaurant or I can now go out to a nightclub.
We get to get dressed up tonight.
Out, right? And I can definitely see it going one of two ways. Or maybe, you know, you'll have that one experience and that one time where you're just like, oh, I'm gonna live. I'm gonna really enjoy this. And so I can definitely see people getting excited about that too. What's the first event they're gonna attend? You know, the first graduation or a wedding or something like that. Yeah. And I can see people kind of going all out for those and really living it up. And then maybe for their regular workwear, kind of getting back to the new pandemic fashion.
And that's Daniel Mathras, an associate teaching professor of marketing at Northeastern University, about how our pandemic wardrobe could shape future dress codes. That is Insight for today. Learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. big thank you to our technical director, Mark Jones, and engineer, James Tejada. And we'll catch you back here on Monday when we talk about legislation around gun laws. Make it a great rest of your day.